This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, today's guests are guitarist and lead vocalist Aaron Barrett and trumpet player and backing vocalist extraordinaire Scott Klopfenstein from the Orange County, California ska punk band Real Big Fish. Together we break down the writing, recording, and inspiration behind their breakout hit single, Sellout, taken from their 1996 album, Turn the Radio Off. If you were trying to explain to someone what 1990s third wave ska sounds like, Sellout is a great place to start. From a ska punk standpoint, this song has it all. Great horns, a great melody, killer harmonies, and a relatable and believable lyric. The band had road tested the song live prior to recording the album and knew that it worked well in a live setting. But other than that, Sellout was initially just another new song among the bunch. Scott had just joined the band about a year prior to writing the song, and the harmonies and horn arrangements that Scott brought to Real Big Fish truly set them apart from a lot of other ska punk bands. Oh, and who knew that Aaron channeled Morrissey for the vocal melodies on the verses of Sellout? I sure didn't. For all this and a whole lot more, don't touch that dial.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Oh, are you talking to us?
Hi.
Yeah, that was your cue to say hello.
Oh, I thought you were saying, like, what's up, guys, to the people in podcast land.
I could do that, too. What's up, everybody listening in podcast land? Hello, Aaron. Hello, Scott. And hello to Scott's dog, Max Headroom, is in the room. So.
How you doing, Chris?
I am doing fantastic, and I may have to take a hiatus from touring, because you guys, and I mean this, you both look fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you.
We feel fantastic.
Yeah. It's a lot of day naps.
I mean, I don't know how he feels. The royal we feels fantastic.
The royal we. Well, what's interesting here is, you know, the song we're going to talk about today, Sellout, you co-wrote together. But I want you guys to take us back, because in my mind, Scott, you were with the band the whole time. And there wasn't, many years where you weren't with them. You joined for, I'm assuming, did you join on the tour for Everything Sucks? I know you didn't play on that record, but did you start touring with the band then, or did you join right for Turn the Radio Off?
I joined a couple days before the CD release party of Turn the Radio Off.
No.
Everything Sucks, I mean.
Okay. Because my earliest memories were you were there, you know. So when I went back and was researching, I'm like, oh, he didn't play on the first record. And, you know, I noticed you had, I believe, three co-writing credits on Turn the Radio Off. So talk about that time period. Here you get into a band. Did you know Aaron? Did you know the guys?
Well, yeah. So I had known Aaron and the gang from, I was in a band called The Scott Wolf. Going way back, I was
coming to the shows
fan for like ever. The first time I saw Real Big Fish was I was a freshman in high school, and they played a like school carnival situation, and I saw the band. I was like, I'm gonna be in that band. I don't know how.
You went to that?
I went to that show.
Oh man!
Yeah, and I was like, I have to be in this band. I don't know how. And
did I give you a tape for free one time?
Yes. Yes, you did. I still have that tape.
Wow, you still owe me $5.
It's true. I'll Venmo you. But we, from then on, and then it was one of those things where, I don't know if anybody else ever had this, but it was when you're a kid and you see bands and like they put out albums, especially back in the day, you're like, no way I can do that. I'm just a little bric-a-brac-a.
And, no way could I have a homemade tape of my own.
Yeah.
That I... made the J card at Kinko's.
You know, and so,
yeah.
But then I, like, going to see Real Big Fish that one time, I was like, oh, this is something you can just do with people if they let you.
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh, no, if you're annoying enough and you're just around all the time, they eventually say, well, you should be doing something instead of bothering me.
Well, when I quit Real Big Fish in 1993,
yeah,
I tried to start my own band,
mm-hmm.
and we had one rehearsal.
One rehearsal.
And you were supposed to be there, because I knew you from Los Alamitos High School.
Mm-hmm. And I was there.
You were on some vacation or something, so you weren't able to make it.
Well, there were two rehearsals, because there was one that we had in Andrew's garage.
Oh.
So there was one.
They were both there.
There was one I went to, and then one that I went on vacation. And I was new to being in a band, so I didn't realize how it worked. I also had that thing where it's like, I was not the most confident child back then, or I didn't know how to mask it behind, you know, psychopathy. And so it was like, oh, I didn't know I was important to the band. I just thought, oh, do I have to call to let you know I might not be at the next practice because we're going on a family vacation? And so I realized later on, after we put out Cheer Up, that was a problem. And so then I started letting people know after Cheer Up what I was doing.
Sometimes. Yeah. But anyway, so he didn't show up to that practice, so that didn't work out. So me and Matt and Andrew started Real Big Fish version 2 up again with me singing lead all the time instead of one song.
I think, of course, your addition to the band, I mean, the harmonies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so first I joined the Scholars playing...
That's
trombone.
Right. So he joined the band that I was in called the Scholars playing trombone.
And they had that two guys singing, harmonizing with each other thing, and it was so awesome.
I mean, there was like the Dance Hall Crashers.
Oh, yeah,
and
I was obsessed with that.
You know, there were a lot of bands that were, you know, in Hepcat and like two people singing harmonies Hepcat with each other. And it was like, oh, that's awesome. Smothers Brothers.
So I'm like, I want this guy in my band still. Can you now be in the band now that it's been a few years? And he was like, okay.
And I was like, sure, school's not important to me.
And speaking of not telling people stuff, Matt Wong was really mad that these guys showed up and said they're in the band and he didn't know about it. I don't think he ever forgave either one of us for that. Sorry, Matt Wong.
Have you guys ever thought about this, though? Have you ever thought about back then? Because none of us knew each other. I mean, we weren't part of your scene, definitely less than Jake. We were over, you know, 1,500, 2,000 miles away over in Florida. So
yeah.
Think about all the bands, our band, your band, that Goldfinger. We all kind of sounded like each other a little bit. You know, we had the upstrokes. It was an amalgamation of all that stuff we were listening. East Definitely. Coast punk rock, West Coast punk rock. You mentioned Dance Hall Crashers, Operation Ivy. You know, bands like New York Citizens over in New York that were doing the harmony thing, the Toasters. And it's just amazing. Now with a press of a button, we can hear what someone's doing in another locale. But back then we didn't know and we were finding out about these bands.
Yeah, back then you had to search for stuff.
Yeah.
And when I discovered the, what was it? The Misfits of, not Misfits, of, it's California Skaquake.
Oh yeah, California Skaquake.
When I got that compilation, I was like, this is the sound I'm looking for.
Yeah. Well, and I think we all benefited from what happened with the Boss Tones in the early 90s. You know, Someday I Suppose was like, that changed the sound of everything. I mean, if you know this thing
that used to
exist called radio, and it was like, you know, it was like the slow upbeats with, you know, the halftime break, and then, you know, the horn section, and there was distorted guitars. It was like, wait, what is happening?
Someday I'm supposed to break the time. I wanna be and spend a storyline that's happy in the end. Plans are never promises, certainly uncertain. I can't wait to sit these things before they close the curtain. One day, who knows? Someday, I suppose.
Well, and we also had
every sound that I loved all together.
And we had the good graces also of Fishbone.
Oh, yeah.
Which was hugely influential.
Oh, man.
Yeah, which was
that
like
was a big record.
All of a sudden punk rock and like metal and soul and ska and reggae and everything all put together and funk. It was like, oh, you mean you can just kind of do anything with it, and as long as you're paying respect, it's going to tend to work out.
So to answer your question, yeah, Scott joined the band in 1995, right before the release of the Everything Sucks album.
you look back again that to that time period, 95, 96, when you guys were first starting, I saw you guys and I thought you were great. But looking back, you know, if I were to go back and look at videos from you in 96, we weren't great. We were all learning our footing and learning our instrumentation. And then
no, you guys were great. I saw you guys play.
Were great.
We tried.
I saw Les and Jake, and it was an inspiration to me too. It was like, wow, those guys are so funny on stage, and they're like rocking out and doing backflips, and like, oh my, and the whole crowd singing along to their songs. I can't believe it. I've never seen that in a small local show.
And there was Faith Healing. Wait, was that a different show?
Yeah, I'm telling you guys, it can't be understated. The time that we had, I can speak for all of us, because it was every day was something exciting, and every day was just, by the point that time we met you guys, we had just got signed to Capitol. Okay. And some of my listeners may have heard me tell this story, but you know, we were at the crossroads of going to radio for the first time, and they wanted to send our song Johnny Quest Thinks for Sellouts to radio. And Vinny and I were just like, we can't do that. You know, Real Big Fish is already on the radio with a song called Sellout. Okay. And I know there's going to be people probably writing to the Facebook page arguing with me. I'm not looking for an argument here. This is my opinion. I told my radio guy, I said, Sellout, it's a more complete song. And it is. It is compared to our track.
It's Sellout better than Johnny Quest Thinks for Sellouts. Come
okay,
on.
But hold on. So the song, as you guys know, did fantastic at radio and MTV. It was meant to be. Even if they would have went Capitol with Johnny Quest Thinks for Sellouts, I don't think it would have done anything. We went with a different song. But that time period when you wrote Sellout, did you have any idea at all? Like, or was it just another album track?
I don't know. I think it was just part of the next batch of songs.
Yeah.
After the Everything Sucks album, you know, that those songs were written and recorded and put out there, and then it was just, you know,
I mean,
time to write some new songs. And
yeah, I mean, I think even back then, putting out Everything Sucks was such an undertaking.
Yeah,
like that, the idea of
not many bands had a CD back then, so it was a big deal.
We thought in batches of songs, kind of.
Yeah,
I feel like, and you know, especially at that time, you're evolving constantly too, so. It always seemed like there were like three or four songs where this set of influences came in.
Yeah, just
and then
discovering
you discover
new sounds,
a new record, and then there were three or four more songs that like brought that in and changed it all around.
And for Sellout, I think at that time I just discovered Dancehall Crasher's old record, and then Lockjaw had just come out.
Oh God,
yeah.
And I just listened to Lockjaw nonstop. That was such a big influence on me. And
I can't believe that record wasn't a 5 million seller. Lockjaw, it was so good.
Yeah,
so good.
I know.
Sellout's the first track on the record. It opened the album. And do you recall playing it before you recorded it? Did you have anything to go on with the song? Any audience reaction that you saw prior to recording it?
I think we knew when we wrote the song that it was a good one. It was going to be the one that you ended the set with, or, you know, started the set with, just like a big, powerful, rocking song. So it was either a big finish or a big intro to the show. So we would usually play it in the middle.
Yeah. But I feel like even at
back
that
then.
Time, to think about what we were doing as anything that would be considered a hit was like baffling. It was like
we're just trying to write our own songs.
We were just like,
and figure out how to do it.
We're just doing it, you know, and we're doing the thing that feels most natural and still challenging to us. And it's like, so to even hear it now and think about it as a hit is still like, so
I don't know
foreign.
I don't know if any artist or band can listen to their own song and go,
that's a hit.
You hear how it was made and you remember all the things you went through, and so you don't hear it how anyone else does.
I mean,
so
it's
you can't listen to your own stuff and go, yeah, that's a hit.
Chris, I don't know, or I don't know about both either of you guys, but do you ever feel like when you listen to your music, you're like, well, it's good, but I don't know if it sounds like a song. Like, you're like, I mean, listen to this. This is a song. And what I wrote, it's a thing that has parts, and there's a throughness to it, but I don't think it's not like a song. It's like a song.
It definitely was so strange to hear it, you know, on the radio or to see the video come on MTV. It's like, what is this doing here? This does not belong here. This is wrong.
Yeah, and then you're out doing the old radio show junket where you're out there. And we met you guys on a bunch of those, and it was just an absolutely wild time. And
you know, how many times have I heard this song? And you know, as recent as a couple years ago, Aaron, when you were still out there touring, we'd be out there together. And it was like, I had to see this song every night. If I'm passing down the hallway, I'd go out and watch it just to watch the crowd.
It's still got that great reaction every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unreal. Well, I want to jump into the song, which I got to tell you guys, this kind of shocked me, and I figured out why when I went through it, and we'll get there. But this song's 3 minutes and 47 seconds long.
It's pretty long.
That's a long song.
Yeah. A lot of times on like TV shows and stuff, they would make us cut the outro or something or shorten it in some way because they only had, you know, 2.5 minutes or whatever of time.
Or when we
for
go
us.
Right into the bridge, they'd cut out the extra ba ba da da.
Okay. Like okay. That. Yeah.
We play it extra fast.
Yeah. Generally, it depends on the drummer. It was extra fast.
Well, the album was, I guess, co-produced by Jay Rifkin, who was with Mojo.
He won a Grammy for the Lion King soundtrack.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And John Avila, who was the bassist in Oingo Boingo.
Yep. Yeah.
So, do you recall the song changing from when you brought it in? And did you record a demo? Do you remember?
We didn't record any demos. I think we did one or two pre-production days, and they came in and listened to us play the songs, and they just went, I don't know what the fuck to do with this. No, I do remember on Sellout, you know, the outro has the, it was a punk rock beat at first. They changed that, and then they added the Sellout, boop, with me.
Oh, okay. Right.
The horn stabs.
A few little horn things, but mostly it was all already ready to go.
Yeah. I feel like we got a lot of freedom on that record. And maybe this was more of a testament to what was going on in the industry at that time.
Yeah.
It was kind of the tail end of artist development with record labels. Like, you could still get a development deal, and people were interested in letting bands kind of figure out what they wanted to do, because it's like, I feel like in the tail end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, record labels were a little more open to pushing the envelope in alternative music. And then somewhere around, like when we actually kind of got started, they started like pulling back on the reins, and it was less about letting a band that has established themselves doing something and already like being successful, as there were, you know, I mean, Zappa talks about when A&R reps came in, people, taste makers came in to start changing things instead of letting bands explore and like do what they do organically. I feel like we kind of reached that. We were allowed during Turn the Radio Off to participate in kind of the last elements of that. Cause we made that like we'd practiced 2 times a week as well as playing shows generally.
Something like that.
Yeah. We worked hard, and like, so we went in and recorded that record pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, those are the songs we were playing live at every show and everything, so they were pretty well rehearsed, and there was no song that we hadn't played live a million times on that record. Oh, I remember one thing on Sellout.
Was Alternative Girl kind of the newest song that we had at that point?
That was the newest song we had when we recorded that.
On that album.
I remember on Sellout, they wanted to cut the horn line in half the second time.
Oh, that's right.
But we forgot.
Yep.
When we recorded it, so.
So you just kept doing it.
That was the only thing we tried to change. But yeah, that was the whole, that was like the new batch of songs was Sellout, Alternative Baby, She Has a Girlfriend Now, Everything Sucks. I think Nothing was a
Nothing,
new one.
Yeah. And then there was one more. And what's the one that also goes along with Alternative Baby in my mind?
What's the one with the horns?
It's got horns in it. There's some upbeats.
2 for 1 was new.
Yeah.
But that was like the new batch of songs, and I was listening to Lockjaw nonstop when I wrote Sellout, so.
Well, before we start breaking down and getting the nitty gritty here, let's just talk real quick about the term sellout. I mean, how big that term was thrown around in the 90s. And no one cares anymore. Yeah, no, I've talked about it on the show.
I heard Chris Fafalis' podcast talking about Sellout, and he said, that's the most unrelatable song to be a single in the world. Like, who knows what that's about, but a small smidgen of people that can understand, like, what's sellout mean?
Oh, but man, it was every zine. And for those who aren't old enough, that's
at the time,
short for magazine.
The early 90s and stuff, it was the grunge thing
was
coming to an end there, and they talked about selling out and stuff.
Nirvana, oh, that heard you're going to sign to a major label. Like, no, nobody cares. Nobody cares.
That
now.
Term brought in the bands punk rock down. Scene.
Yeah.
I mean, look at what happened to, you know, Jawbreaker. Like,
oh, I know.
They got a record deal. Sellouts.
Oh, they got Rob Cavallo to produce their record, and it's Dear You sounds amazing. amazing. Ah, oh, screw them.
So that probably made the best, one of the best records of their career, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. And that was yeah. one of the things too, which inspired me to write the song, because that was when the Lockjaw Dancehall Crashers came out, there was no horns on it. And a lot of the people in our local scene were like, oh my God, they're changing their sound for the record label, bunch of sellouts. And to me, like, this is the best thing I ever heard. Oh my God. So what if it doesn't have horns? Lots of ska bands don't have horns. Who cares?
Yeah.
Well, and they were smart. This was pre Pro Tools. You couldn't tune the horns. It was hard to find a good horn section. Scott's just kind of like, yeah.
Still is. Yeah.
But the intro is 8 bars. It's that staccato on the toms, that buildup. It reminds me of Lockjaw.
Specials.
There you go.
Specials. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, same.
You got the drums on the toms with bass, a distorted guitar doing a classic ska run, and trombone and trumpet on bar 8. A guitar hammer-on panned off left takes us into 16 more bars. Drums are now playing a straight beat with... You made me laugh almost. The drums are now playing a straight beat along with bass and distorted guitars. Guitars are odd here.
Let's go back to the intro. I want to talk about
real
that.
Real quick. We're going to get there, but the distorted guitars, Aaron, it almost sounds like they're panned off 50% to the left and like 25 or 30 on the right. They're not true stereo guitars, a hard pan left and right. Do you remember that in the mixing process?
I don't remember exactly where they panned them, but on the Turn the Radio Off, that was the first time that I ever doubled my guitar at all. This is what you do with distorted guitars. You do it left and right, and that makes it sound really big and huge. And that's where I learned that. So I didn't know much about mixing back then. You know, I just tried to be, I can't hear the horns.
Yeah.
But that was the engineers and producers that panned those guys.
Who mixed that record?
I think Slam.
Slam Andrews did, yeah.
And John.
And Jay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that 16 bars that come in after the staccato buildup at the top, that's your horn hook right there. And, you know, you guys were talking about having to cut it for late night talk shows and stuff. That part's in here a lot, but I wouldn't change it at all. That horn hook, and I want to talk about that, Scott, from a horn player. You know, you take the chords of this song, and I was sitting here this morning, I'm playing along with it. I said, I want to write 5 different horn parts right now that would work over this. And in my mind, I'm humming them. You know, how did you know this horn part was great? How did you say this is it? And I guess back then we were flying by the seat of our pants. It didn't have to be perfect. We just kind of did.
Yeah. And when we were in the studio, the producers went, hey, you know what? There's one note that doesn't work with the chords. Like, da-da-da. I think it's that note.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit with the chord that's being played on the guitar. And they're like, can we change it to something else? And we just went, I don't think so.
Nope.
And there's oh, well.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know.
And there's probably some terminology like, that's like a fifth over a third octave. You can't do that. JR, my sax player, would know the terminology of it.
I did it, and it works.
It's actually,
it's called
polytonality.
Yeah.
I just had this conversation with somebody who worked on something that I worked on just recently, and a horn line that I wrote that conflicted with the chords. And he's like, oh, that's cool. You put in polytonality. He's like, that's a really hard thing to do. I was like, yes, that's what I did. Why don't you explain it to me just to make sure that I know you know what's going on?
Well, thank you for giving the listeners a little bit of insight into polytonality, because I wouldn't even have gone that far, Scott. I don't want to lose people here. But
no,
okay.
No, for sure. I won't go into explaining what polytonality is. I'm not sure I really get it.
We really knew a lot of musical theory back then.
Yeah, this horn part's great. And as you know, Aaron, you go over to Europe, England, especially South America, they love to sing the horn parts.
Oh, yeah.
I've heard them sing. Isn't that a trip? The first time you heard them sing the horn parts, you're like, whoa.
I think the approach with horn lines in Real Big Fish was always kind of, it needed to be somewhere between a really catchy guitar solo and a horn line. Like,
well, it had to be sing-alongable, because that's what we did. We drove around in my little hatchback listening to ska records and singing along with the horn parts. Like, like on the Wayne's World scene where they're all banging their head to the Queen song.
Right, but as you know, though, with a lot of ska, and you guys, trust me, you lived it. You played every 12-band ska fest in Southern California there was to be had, and
yeah.
we did all those too back in the day, and you just, by the eighth band of horns, you'd be like, oh my gosh, put me out of my misery. But, you know, this horn part in particular, I feel, is just as important in this song as the chorus hook, you know? And that's something about ska, the horns are another voice, definitely in our band too.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
We were a fortunate horn section to be as honored in the arrangements. I mean, Aaron was always you were always big on like let's make sure that what you're doing is just as important as any other melody. And
yeah.
I mean, I feel like that was an Orange County thing though too. Like the horn, we had bands like, again, Hepcat was huge. You know,
No Doubt was the big local band.
No Doubt always, you know, had great memorable horn lines and stuff like that. And it was, I think, because we also didn't necessarily stray away from a certain amount of pop sensibility as well. Like we liked pop music too.
God
forbid.
Something that sticks in your head, something sing-alongable and memorable.
Without being contrite.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we jump right into verse one here.
Wait, I got to tell you about the intro.
Oh yeah, let's talk. let's finish talking about the intro.
So that dun 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 boodly was totally direct ripoff of Dancehall Crashers. The song goes down 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 do 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 do. So I was messing with that, and I made my own riff that went dan 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 doodly doodly. It's different, but it's the same.
And for the listeners that remember, we did have Karina on here talking about Go.
I heard that one.
So, yes, yes. Verse one. Well, I know you can't work in fast food all your life, but don't sign that paper tonight. She
said, but it's too late. Well, I know you can't work in fast food all your life, but don't sign that paper tonight. She said, but it's too late.
The drums, bass, and clean upstroke guitar here. The ska guitar is panned off to the left on the last line, but it's too late. Distorted guitars start creeping back in, and we get a four-bar reintro with that horn hook on verse one here. We get a harmony on, but don't sign that paper tonight. And then we get unison vocals on, but it's too late. How did you guys come up with where the harmonies were going to be and where they were going to be unison? And also, the lead vocal sounds doubled here. Is it doubled?
The lead vocal's not doubled. If it sounds doubled, that means he's singing along unison probably. Scott just does what he does. I don't know. We never really discussed too much.
Mm-mm.
Once in a while, he'd be like, oh, hey, can you not do something here or he just
did. You do any of the unison stuff by yourself, Aaron, or was that Scott?
No, that's all Scott.
It's really hard to tell. I didn't know if you I thought maybe he was doing the high harmonies, maybe you were doing some of that, because sometimes, as you know, in the studio, sometimes when we sing with ourselves, I've done harmonies just on whatever key, for whatever reason I sound better doing a harmony there than one of the other guys in the band.
You're just really good at blending with people.
Yeah. So as a kid, I felt like it was disrespectful to sing along with stuff. So I had to sing harmonies with things. And then through doing that in the car and just at home and stuff, I learned to essentially do vocal impressions. I also I read an interview with Sammy Davis Jr. where he talked about doing that too. And so it was always really important that if it was gonna be something that made sense, what was always incredible to me was the way Aaron said things, the way Aaron sang, the way, you know, Aaron's got a very distinct voice, and it's that's so rare in my opinion in most musical settings. You know, for me it was I don't know where his vocal influences come from. Let's honor that and still make it something that is unique and special and beautiful, that compliments when he's singing by himself and then gets exciting. And yeah, when to harmonize, when to do the thing. It's just, I don't know, just my brain works that way.
Whatever
for some
feels
reason.
Right to you.
Yeah. And at times, yeah, I mean, every once in a while, Aaron's like, ooh, do that in unison. And I do it and I go, you were right.
And for me, just like the more harmonies, the better. So
yeah,
I was like, do your thing.
Yeah, no, I feel like we don't do enough unison stuff. There can be a lot of power in unison when you do it correctly. And
definitely,
you know, the other thing that you brought to the band, Scott, that, you know, bands started doing this after, but you did a lot of falsetto with your harmonies, and there wasn't a lot of bands doing that back then in our scene.
Right. Well, that's the Beach Boys. That's some Brian Wilson.
Sure. Yeah. But yeah, I feel, you know, I'm tooting your horn here. I feel like you were, your band was responsible for that. A lot of bands that came up after you were doing that, that falsetto harmony thing.
About that first verse, I was also listening to Morrissey and the Smiths like constantly nonstop when I wasn't listening to Lockjaw by Dancehall Crashers. And I was like trying to write a Morrissey song at first. And I was like, well, I know you can work in fast food all your life, but don't sign that paper tonight. Like, that's why it's two notes the whole time.
Oh my God. That is so good.
It's Morrissey.
That's so true. Oh, wow. I don't know that.
Do you know
I knew that.
You know what's funny? And I never thought of this till you just sang that, Aaron. This is so funny. It that melody you just sang sounds morose. It doesn't sound like a ska melody.
I was listening to the Smiths nonstop.
Yeah.
It's so good. That makes me so happy.
But I want you, and you want me to, and you need this. Wanna give it to you.
Hey, everybody, don't go anywhere. We got lots more with Scott and Aaron after a few words from our sponsors.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities, from easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock, DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes.
And now, back to the show.
After the first part here, I'd mentioned a little bit ago, we get back to the four-bar reintro.
And I don't remember what I read. I don't remember what they said. I guess it doesn't matter. Guess it doesn't matter anymore.
Then I don't remember what I read. I don't remember what they said. I guess it doesn't matter. Guess it doesn't matter anymore. And the lyrics here, were you just, was this something you had jotted down, or you said, we're going to write a song called Sellout? How did that happen? Do you remember?
You just heard that word so much thrown around. And I don't know. I guess it was just this idea, vague idea I had of how record labels work and how the music industry works, kind of from movies and from interviews I'd heard with Nirvana and different things. So I just kind of had this idea of how record labels work. So I don't know. So I wrote this really vague song. It could be taken any way you want.
I feel like you really bridged the gap, though, and that's something that bothered me a little bit, especially when the scene, when, you know, Moon Records was signing any band that had a horn section, you know, and the scene just burned itself out by the early 2000s. But, you know, you guys seem to be able to straddle the line of the funny or the even cheesy lyric and still sell it and make it sound. You know, a lot of bands were, you know, singing about stuff that was just too floofy for me, and there's something relatable to this lyric.
We don't take it so seriously, but we also don't take it too lightly at the same time. You know, we'll put heart and soul in there if it needs it. We'll be silly and wacky if it needs it.
I feel like Aaron was always trying to, if I can speak for you, was always trying to convince people of, which at times he could and at times was kind of difficult, was it's like Aaron was being as sincere and open and honest like as a human being could be. And though it was tongue in cheek at times, and though it was like sometimes so angry it seemed funny, it's like, I would sometimes spend the night at Aaron's house and I'd sleep on the floor and Aaron would go through, and I kid you not, it was one of the most fascinating things I ever saw or heard, because it was dark in your room because you don't like the sun when you sleep or any kind of light whatsoever or noise, which is why we didn't share hotel rooms much. But he would seriously, in a narrative fashion, link all of the lyrics of all the songs together into like this thing that he would just start talking. And I would, and it was like, it was a fascinating kind of like a beautiful mind, like weird thing that he was like working out loud.
It's like a rock opera in my head.
Yeah. And it was really, I mean, it's like, even to the point where I don't know if a lot of people know this, like, the original name of Turn the Radio Off was supposed to be By This, and we had By artwork this. For it and everything. And then Aaron wrote this essay. Do you remember that? You wrote freaking essay.
Using the lyrics
of the album to explain why he needed to change the name of the album to Turn the Radio Off. And it was like the most compelling and convincing essay. And it was like, you can't argue with that. Like, what I love about Aaron's lyric writing,
this fantasy world that I created in my head.
But it's a mix of like subconscious and conscience and conscious.
And conscience,
you know, while also like being a certain amount self-deprecating, and I think that's the glory of Aaron's lyrics.
But there's an underlying sincerity here that
absolutely.
I know that people
100%
that I know that people feel.
I never thought of it as like joke music or comedy music. Mm-hmm. It was all the lyrics were coming from. Sometimes there were funny things, but of course, but.
Sure. But that helps it sell it. On the second verse here, we get horn stabs after the first two lines. We get a harmony. Don't remember what they said. And then we get unison on I guess it doesn't matter and guess it doesn't matter anymore. On the last line here, there's a nice three-note horn part with a swell that takes us into pre-chorus one.
You're gonna go to the record store. You're gonna give them all your money. Radio plays what they want you to hear. Tell me it's cool. I just don't believe it.
This part. Here's another part of the song that is just so
pre-chorus?
Hooky. It is. It's like, yeah, the pre-chorus of this song is almost like a chorus so in and of parts. Itself. The lyric is, because you're gonna go to the record store. You're gonna give them all your money. Radio plays what they want you to hear. They tell me it's cool. I just don't believe it. The band breaks down here to kick and hi-hat with guitar. The end of every line, there's a snare fill, bass run, and a four-note horn stabs that happen. On the last line here, great drum fill that's locked with the horns and guitars that takes us into chorus one. That line, radio plays what they want you to hear in unison. Why not a harmony? Do you remember? It just sounded good in unison.
Sounded better that way, yeah.
I always ask these questions, and I always see the artist on the other end here just kind of give this look of, because I'll say what I just said, like, why'd you do that? This is going back almost 30 years. I understand that, but to me it's so fascinating because I am such a harmony guy. When I started doing this podcast, and I've done broke down whatever 160 songs now or whatever it's been, I look at placement because I'm reading everything. I make charts and I'm looking at it and I'm like, it just, why did they pick the harmony here? It's so fat. And I'll ask the artist again, in this instance, almost 30 years, and you're going, I don't know, it probably just sounded better.
Well, yeah, I think that line too, I guess it doesn't matter anymore. Like, you don't need to jazz it up. You don't need to like blow it up. It's a pretty powerful line.
Yeah, there's the unison and then the harmony comes in on the next part.
Right. I never really think about the fact that there's 80,000 parts, and it's like a freaking prog rock song.
So weird.
We wrote a Yes Ska song, for God's sake.
There's a lot going on here, and I'll repeat what I said at the top or earlier. You know, this song is a very complete song. It's very well thought out and constructed.
Sell out with me, oh yeah. Sell out with me tonight. The record company's gonna give me lots of money, and everything's gonna be alright.
The chorus lyric is sell out with me, oh yeah. Sell out with me tonight. The record company's gonna give me lots of money, and everything's gonna be all right. The drums go halftime here, with the bass laying down a killer groove. The ska guitar is panned off left, almost with a reggae feel here. The whole thing just changes. It's such a great breath of fresh air. It's only a minute and 2 seconds, and you're at the...
You gotta have the jump part.
Yeah, you gotta have the jump part. Yeah.
That's another way that, like, especially back in those days, we wrote songs for the crowd, like, okay, you're gonna do the ska dance here for a while, and then we're gonna give you a break and do a breakdown, then we're all gonna jump, then the circle pit happens, oh, not too much, let's go back to the reggae. You're like,
yeah.
That's such a great point, though, because we would write like that too. You would think, what would I like to if I was at a show? Oh, we got to hit the bounce part here. You would think of those things because we never...
Yeah, it's not just about singing along, it's about dancing along too.
No, yeah, especially in the early days, recording was secondary to us. It was always about the live show.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what we thought of most of the time, was the live show.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting.
How is this going to go live?
Our chorus... kind of like, especially in those times, you know, it's like it was that Pixies model of the quiet, loud, quiet, right? Where it's like, oh, yeah, the chorus would be the big thing. And we just sucked all the air out of it and we're like, nope, let's slow down and let's have a really like nice jumping. Like,
yeah, I think for Sellout, that was a little departure from what we'd usually get loud in the chorus. Yeah. And this time we're like, let's get quieter on the chorus.
Yeah,
just for slowing down, things up, try something new.
That is so crazy. You guys are blowing my mind because I don't have that written in the notes, and I've known you guys forever, heard the song a million times, and never thought about that. You know, after this breakdown part of the pre-chorus, it should just have big distorted guitars and go somewhere huge and lift, and you guys went completely opposite. That's awesome.
Yeah, and with that da 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 da, like it's... Oh, it's so funny.
No, I've often said when I look at it on paper like this, it shouldn't work. You're like, wait, like you said, you suck the air out of a room. Wait. But it is the jumping part. The part is great.
It's the jumping part.
You get harmonies on the first two lines. Sell out with me, oh yeah. Sell out with me tonight. And on the third line, all the way up to everything's gonna be. And then all right is in unison. No harmony there. I guess it sounded better to say all right in unison, huh?
Yep.
Because I sang a harmony over it this morning and it worked beautifully, but it's not there.
Yeah. I mean, I also, there were times where, and I think this was, I don't do many things in my life with conscious decision. I just don't believe in it, much to many of the people in my life's chagrin. But there were times where it was like, for me, the unison was an exclamation point. It really brought something home. There was an idea of togetherness and like a shared idea and feeling and thought that was important to me to represent in the work, in Aaron's lyrics and in the music.
I'm glad you brought that up. I've talked about that before, where I feel sometimes a lyric is just too personal to have anything on it. It's something that the person just sings and you're like, oh, there was harmonies everywhere else on that line except the very end of the song. It had to be personal there from one person's point of view. And that's a great point you just brought up.
I've always felt honored to do the work. You know, like it's an honor to be able to be asked to share in the vocalizing of a feeling, a thought, and an experience, right? So like if you do any less than pay it respect and like think about it from a sincere perspective... I think it's disrespectful to the song, to the artist, to the audience, and to yourself.
And I've had these conversations outside of the show over the years with people that echoed a lot of what you just said, Scott. And I've talked to other musicians and artists that just, they would never, ever, their mind wouldn't go there where your mind went. And that doesn't mean that they're wrong or whatever, but
no.
You know, looking at it like you're looking at it, I look at it like that a lot. I'm like, what does a lot of times the hardest thing to say to yourself as a musician is, what does the song call for? You know, not what I think it
needs. Instead of what's fun for me to play or what part is fun for me.
Yeah.
You got to think of what's right for the song.
Yeah. I mean, and there were definitely times where it's like, I was just told by somebody, I had this, met somebody who was they're a music theory professor and all sorts of stuff. And they're like, you know, a lot of the choices you made vocally as a harmonizer don't make sense. And I was like, to who? Like,
made sense like to you?
Makes sense to your pinche rules. Like that's like ridiculous. Like it worked and people never questioned it. Like, you know, that was also part of my thing too, is it's like I also don't like following predictable rules.
Mm-hmm.
As it's like, if this has been done, let's find a way to do it better.
Oh, I mean, yeah, that was the one thing that set you guys apart for sure.
That is true.
No, they were your harmonies. I'm for sure. You weren't just doing thirds.
Yeah.
There was some odd, what those people were calling odd. I'm going to say it again. Odd note choices, not the first go-to choices that you would think of as harmonizing with. And you did a superb job with picking some cooler notes. Like, what if we tried this?
Which, I mean, honestly, like, I know at times it was difficult for Aaron to just to trust me and let me do my thing.
Yeah, it would be. And it is for me a lot of times. And I've had that happen. Not so much anymore, but.
I don't know. I think I always let you do whatever you want because it always sounded awesome.
Yeah. There were always, everything. That was always the amazing thing. It was like, oh.
Very rarely it was like, you know what? Can you try this instead? Because most of the time Scott just nails it with whatever he comes up with.
That's awesome. Well, right after chorus one, and this is why the song's so long. It's not an 8-bar full band reintro. We get a full another 16 bars like the top of the song.
Yeah, I was saying they tried to cut that in half, but we forgot when we were doing the tracking. So
yeah,
and no one remembered they told us to do that.
So, I'm not kidding.
There was so much nonsense going on.
If you would have told me when I started, you know, really researching and diving into this song that it was 2 minutes and 47 seconds, I would have believed it. But 3:47 is a little on the longer side because but the parts are needed. We talked about this horn part. It's just as big of a hook as anything in the song. Verse 3.
No more flipping burgers, putting on my silly hat. You know I don't want that no more. And I shouldn't ask when we get paid. Quit my day job anyway. I guess it doesn't matter. Guess it doesn't matter anymore.
No more flipping burgers, putting on my silly hat. You know I don't want that no more. And I didn't ask when we'd get paid. I quit my day job anyway. I guess it doesn't matter. Guess it doesn't matter anymore.
No more flipping burgers, putting on my silly hat. You know I don't want that no more.
You need to feed that into the AI
seriously
algorithm and say, hey, create a song in the style of the Smiths, but with this lyric. And it'll do it.
That's what I did.
I love this verse. Okay. Drums, bass, ska guitar, panned off, lefter here again. But on the second line, we get that harmony on Don't Want That No More. The horn comes in here and it plays basically the intro hook here. And I love how this is totally different. The placement here is different than verse one and verse two. Do you recall how that happened? It's kind of strange here, this verse.
It's not exactly the same. So we had to change the horn line a little bit just to fit it all in, right?
Well, yeah, because on the first time you go back to the 4-bar reintro, but here you're basically bringing the horns from the hook back in. I just think it's, again, how many times have I heard this song? But looking at it now, it's genius. This third verse is just, it has a different feel than the other two, and I love that.
I'm going to say what so many of your guests on your podcast always say. Hey, man, I was just a teenager. I didn't know what I was doing.
And
I was just throwing stuff together because it sounded like music.
I'm glad you said that because I'd love to be able, just speaking for myself, to get back to that mindset a little bit. Like, the song's good enough.
Yeah, it's really
the song's done.
Impossible to get back to that
way
of writing because you just didn't know. Everything was new. Everything was exciting because it's like, let's try this. I've never done anything before.
Right. Yeah. So I'll get Buddy.
Try dancing when you write it.
Yeah, that'll work.
Buddy sometimes will send me, like, I'll have a demo that I send him, and he'll send me 5 different horn parts, an intro. And I'm like, Okay. They all work note-wise. They all start and end where they're supposed to. I don't know which one to pick. They're all great. You know, he writes some pretty darn catchy horn lines. And to look back and just know you guys were kids. And
it was the first thing that came to your mind back then. Whatever you came up with, the first thing, that was how the song went. And that's it.
Yes.
Well, and the stakes were so, like, there were no stakes back then either.
You had nothing to lose. It was
something to be said about being able to create something that it was really just about like you having fun and then the people who came having fun and like you feeling proud of something you made. There was no like how much, I mean, this was we hadn't made it at that point. Like when we wrote the song, we were still like, living at
local
home
bands,
and you know, it was, you know, I think I was still in high school when we wrote the song.
Yeah, you were like 16 or 17.
You were like, third out of 12 at, you know, at the Sunday matinee at the Showcase in Corona.
Totally. Yeah. And so it was just like, you didn't have that same pressure and achievement bar to meet. So
the only real thing that you're concerned about, like, I got to make those people in the crowd move.
Yeah. And
you wanted to impress the other bands that you were playing with too. You wanted because we were always playing with people we loved and respected.
Yeah.
We were so grateful to be able to be a part of the Orange County scene that was like full of so many great bands. And then when bands from out of town would come, we'd be like, oh my gosh, we gotta be really cool to make sure that we these people want to hang out with us and play with us more.
Yeah. And it's amazing. You know, there's the ska festival out there. We played Back to the Beach a couple years ago. Watching you guys there, Aaron, was just, and Goldfinger, that Southern California scene. Anybody that ever listened to that kind of music was there. All 30,000 of them going mental. And I wasn't from Southern California, but I was there. I was out. We were with Capitol Records at that time. I was playing in Southern California, seeing this whole thing unfold. It really was remarkable.
Yeah.
So on verse 3, we get the harmony on Don't Want That No More and Quit My Day Job Anyway. The last two lines are in unison before we get to pre-chorus 2. Same instrumentation and lyrics as pre-chorus 1. Then we get into chorus 2.
You're gonna go to the record store. You're gonna give them all your money. Radio plays what they want you to hear. Tell me it's cool, I just don't believe it. Sell out with me, oh yeah. Sell out with me tonight. The record company's gonna give me lots of money, and everything's gonna be.
Again, same instrumentation and lyrics here. We get the horn stabs there on the first two lines. The last line here, and everything's gonna be. There's no all right there. Was that ever discussed? Because it could have been there.
I think the whole thing was, the song was like, I was unsure of everything. I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this and everything's going to be all right. And then I'm sort of thinking twice by the next time, like, everything's going to be, is this going to be all right? And I don't know. There's doubt in my mind as to whether I do want to sell out or not. At first I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. And then wait a minute, should I do this?
It's got a suspenseful feel to it. I've never thought about this part again till I looked at the lyrics here and I realized that all right's missing. And I'm reading through and I'm going, yeah, why isn't it there? And I've never, how many times I sat backstage, I could have asked you a million times. I've never asked you, and now I know the reason why. And I think you're right. I think you didn't need to be said there. Was it said there, or did you just leave it out?
It was also our attempt at Buddhism. You know, I guess it's just gonna be.
It's just going to be. It's a Zen thing.
Exactly. Everything's going to be.
Back
to the intro.
After chorus two, we go
back to the intro.
Exactly. And why not? Why wouldn't we go back to one of the catchiest parts of the song? Although, not 16 bars here. We get an 8-bar reintro of the very top of the song. This time, the drums and the rest of the band aren't playing that staccato beat. On bar 8, it's just a snare and guitar panned off left that takes us into the bridge. I love this bridge, and I don't think it'll be so bad. And I know it won't be so bad. Because the man said, that's the way it is. And the man said, it don't get better than this. No, no, no. We get harmonies on that's the way it is. Better than this. And no, no, no. Talk about this part. Was this something that John or Jay, do you remember talking to them about it? Was this how it was written?
That's how it was written. That was, I think the only thing that was added was a little, some horn pads.
Yeah.
Right? They encouraged the swell thing. We never used to do the swells.
Yeah.
But they really, that was their thing. Like, you guys got to do some swells on the horns.
Think about maybe putting in some dynamics instead of just pedal to the metal. Which really saved our chops during 2.5 hour shows.
Yeah.
Talking about John Avila, because I know he did the second record with you guys. And
yes, he did.
You know, the touring that you guys did between this record and Why Do They Rock So Hard? I mean, you guys did probably 300 shows. I mean, everyone was touring a ton back then. When I heard the first single, The Setup, I couldn't believe what the horns, and they still sound amazing on that whole record. You guys really grew in that year, especially the horn section.
Oh,
you could hear it because it was pre-Pro Tools. You had to be able to play it.
Yeah, that's what comes with just playing nonstop, just show after show after show, night after night after night.
Yeah. I mean, I even notice between those two records, I mean, there was a huge leap in the way Aaron and I both sang.
Yeah.
Like, my voice on Turn the Radio Off is actually almost, though the notes are still the same and high, the tone of it is darker and deeper. And I learned how to kind of like switch it up to be a little more complimentary to what Aaron was doing so that it was, and also worked better in the mix.
And I didn't learn to sing until like halfway through Cheer Up.
I wouldn't have, I wouldn't know that. I thought you sang just fine, but I know where you're coming from when you say that.
Yeah, I had a sore throat every time I sang. I wasn't doing anything right. And, you know, I'd lose my voice halfway through every show. And I finally, through the making of Cheer Up, I thought, you know what? I should learn how to sing a little bit so that this isn't painful and I don't lose my voice forever.
But I will say it, before Cheer Up, we met CeCe DeVille and he said, hey, you guys sing like Boyds.
Really?
CeCe DeVille from Poison.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, right after the bridge, we go into pre-chorus 3, same instrumentation, but we get a different lyric here.
So I signed on to the record company. They said they're gonna give me lots of money if I play what they want you to hear. Tell me it's cool, not sure, believe it.
So I signed on to the record company. They say they're gonna give me lots of money if I play what they want you to hear. Tell me it's cool, and I'll sure believe it. We changed up the lyrics. What was the reason here? You want a little more information?
Don't I say I don't believe it? What are the lyrics to my own song?
Tell me it's cool. Well, here it said, and I'll sure believe it.
I signed on to the record company. I signed on to the record company. Said they're going to give me lots of money if I play what they want you to hear. Tell me it's cool. I just
believe it.
And I should believe it. Oh, yeah, because the first few times I don't believe
it.
Yeah,
right.
And now I do believe it.
Is it man or and? I think I've been saying man the whole time.
Oh, I'm saying and.
Oh, man, I sure believe it.
Manned.
Was this a producer suggestion? We need some more lyrics here.
If you listen to the Real Big Fish records, you could hear a lot of times where we're saying different words. He thinks I'm saying one thing, and then I'm saying something else.
I don't ever get a lyric sheet. I just do.
But it sounds like you pick it up the lyrics real quick, so I'm like, oh, he's got it. All right, let's go.
Hey, times were tough back then. Printer ink wasn't cheap.
No,
it's true.
No, we had to handwrite everything back then, so it was like,
the bass player might get a lyric sheet. He doesn't even sing, but Scott's not getting a lyric sheet. You're down on the totem pole. pre-chorus 3, we go right into chorus 3.
Sell out with me, oh yeah, sell out with me tonight. The record company's gonna give me lots of money and everything's gonna be all right.
Sell out with me, oh yeah, sell out with me tonight. Harmonies on both of those lines. And then we get the vocals by themselves. The record company's gonna give me lots of money and everything's gonna be. And there's a big band hit on B that takes us into another full band reintro with the horn hook for 16 bars again. it's long. On bar 15 and 16, the band hits together as the horn continues the hook.
that she said, but I can't work in fast food all my life.
Yeah. The record company's gonna make everything all right. The drums are going double time here. You talked about that earlier, Aaron.
Like the song's been going on for 4, 5, 6 minutes. Let's not end it yet. Let's do an outro.
Yeah, let's do an outro with the snare double time.
Really take it home.
on the line, make everything all right. The vocals are in unison there. And then there's 8 bars of full band. The horns are by themselves for 4 bars before ending with vocals. There's also a noodly guitar overdub that's panned off to the right. And the last lines with vocals are, "Baby, don't you sign that paper tonight," she said, "but I can't work in fast food with a harmony on all my life." And the song comes to an end. What did you guys think when you get the mixes back from the record? Was this still just another song at that point? Or were you like, I think there's something here?
When I heard those first mixes, I was horrified.
Were you?
They had put like all this reverb on the horns. It sounded so weird and strange and overdone, so we went back in and mixed it again.
Yeah,
took all the reverb out.
Teach people how to make the sound that we wanted to hear.
And the horn, the horns weren't loud enough too.
Yeah,
and that was the thing. Like, it was a horn
band.
Did you
guys find that too? Is it's like you'd get these industry cats to come in, and you know, I mean, like, they're doing their job, they're doing the best they can, but you're like, no, you don't understand what we're trying to do here. Like, the horns aren't just, you know, the horns are important. This is
just as important as the lead vocal.
Yeah, it's like, you kind of had to train people.
We did. There was definitely a learning curve, but I also feel like John, being from Oingo Boingo, because their recordings weren't overwashed in reverb. I know he didn't mix the record, but you would have thought that he would have come in at some point and been like, you know, because you certainly, when you guys played live, didn't sound like you were in a in a tunnel.
Well, now looking back, you know, 30 years later, I'm sure it sounded pretty good, but as a whatever the vision we had in our heads,
yeah.
And whatever we were listening to at the time, like, that doesn't sound like what we want it to sound like. And I mean, I think that's what it was.
What John and Jay, I mean, whatever their journey was together as like people, because they also both had very different sensibilities. So whatever their conversations
and just,
in the
you
room
know,
were
this,
like,
this band, that, this band that like doesn't know what they're doing, obviously nothing really works when you look at it musical theory wise or whatever, but they are all playing at the same time and the parts are there. So let's just push record on this and polish this turd the best we can.
Yeah.
I think that's what they were going through.
So one last thing before we wrap up here. And do you guys find this? Because I hear this song in the strangest of places. It follows me around. I'll be walking past a Hollister in a mall on a day off somewhere.
This song?
You know, and I'll hear it coming out of a store, and I'll just kind of have a chuckle for a moment, you know? And there's other places. I'll hear it at the supermarket sometimes, you know? And it's like,
oh, that's my dream. I still haven't heard us at the supermarket.
No, but it's...
Oh, man.
What?
I would love to.
What does that feel like to you guys? I know what it feels like to me. I never thought it would elicit this reaction in me, but I get the same feeling as when I heard, you know, Sell Out somewhere. I get giddy. It's something I did 30 years ago. I never in my life thought it would have legs this long.
I heard it on the radio recently, and for the very first time, like, this is a pretty good song. Yeah. I think I listened to it without
prejudice,
you know, junk attached to it. And I said, this is really strange, unique, fun. I actually appreciate it for the first time in my life. This was about last year.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm still constantly in awe of like what we did and how it was received and what it meant to people and what it continues to mean to people. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the only thing I can really, it's like when the Pick It Up Ska movie came out, it was actually one of the first times I was like, wait a minute.
We were part of something really special.
We meant something to a lot of people, and it's like, that's like, you can't.
It meant a lot to us.
It meant,
but just to know that,
you know,
it really meant a lot to a lot of people.
And it's like, you know, it's oftentimes like, you know, I just moving back to Southern California, like when people, I go, oh, I was in this band, Real Big Fish. They go, oh, Sell Out, and you're like, yes, it's like a currency in a weird way that I definitely didn't get in New York, but. but you also start to realize the impact that you made without even knowing it. Like, I don't know. Yeah. It somehow was like compartmentalized just by being like, I know there's a ton of people at each show, but then like, maybe I'm solipsistic and I just think like once people are out of my sight, they no longer exist. And this is all a simulation that only exists for me. But
you really touched their lives.
Yeah.
And in the same way that these bands touched our lives. And it's amazing to think that we did something for some, for a music listener that
was done
band
for
we loved did for us.
Yeah, yeah. It was that we've been able to pay this thing forward to use a corny phrase.
I love hearing that. Cause that to me is what it's all about. Now, before we break, guys, Aaron, what do you got coming up with your life? Anything musical going on? I'm not going to pry here too much, but I'd love to see you back on a stage someday. Same with you, Scott. Same with you. What's going on?
Scott's on stage all the time. He just got back from a tour.
I know he is. He's constantly busy.
But speaking of Turn the Radio Off, the Enjoy the Ride Records is putting out another pressing of Turn the Radio Off with bonus live tracks of old stuff. And the version of Hate You that we recorded for Turn the Radio Off that was not released, which is so horrible. But it's on there now.
Because people want to hear it. People want to hear us at our worst.
The one with the original horn line?
I don't know. Yeah. So that's coming out eventually.
Wow.
Through them.
That's all right. Cool. Well, I guess I can't. I guess I'm not going to be able to break the Real Big Fish reunion here on Krista Makes a Podcast this episode. And
check out Scott's Twitch. Scott has a Twitch thing you got to check out.
Yeah. So I've been doing Twitch 4 times a week since the pandemic kind of hit. And then I've been releasing music. Some of it's under my own name. And then I'm also rebranding the Littlest Man Band project that I did back in 2005.
Cool.
So, yeah, I've gotten some really great musicians. I actually recorded 2 songs recently and like had like the dream dudes come in. It was Tony Austin from Kamasi Washington's band played drums.
Oh, wow.
And then Dennis Hamm, the keyboard player from Thundercats band, came in and played keys for me. And it was like, and then I got Ed Campworth from Suburban Rhythm and the Long Beach Double All Stars to come play bass.
That's rad.
And then I've got this great horn section that I've been working with for a while. And it's this dude named Edgar Guadiana, who plays in a satanic doo-wop band called Twin Temple.
Satanic doo-wop.
Check out Twin Temple. They're amazing.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, and I did it with John Avila, actually. I did the recordings with John Avila. And so we released one of the songs last month, and then we'll be releasing one in June. But I'm slowly, we're back in that single culture where it's like doing a record's not really what you release singles in, then you package it as an album. So just constantly doing stuff. And touring.
Where are you going next?
Right now, I don't know. I think there's a phone call that I'm on today that we're talking about what we're going to be doing for August. And then I'm going to be actually in the Strawberry Festival parade here in Garden Grove, California.
Really?
At the end of May. They've asked me to be a celebrity parade so I get to sit in a classic car and wave at people.
That's awesome.
I might shave.
I love it. Please get some video of it. Guys, thanks. Thank you so much for sitting in. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks so good to see you.
Yeah,
you
this too. Is fun.
You too.
And stare at the moon. And we sleep in smart feet. Take a walk through the sand, over a rock, over a river.
The song that you're hearing is Sidle Up from the Littlest Man Band. Make sure, if you haven't already, go check out the Littlest Man Band. And I hope you all enjoyed that episode with Aaron and Scott. I thought it was awesome. I can't wait to talk to Chris about it in the rap segment that's coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Andy DeFranco, Wolfpack, Keb Mo, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to the show on the road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
Do you like to laugh, geek out on music, and learn all about that band or artist who had that one song back in the day, but then seemed to fall off the face of the earth? If so, you need to subscribe to One Hit Thunder. Together with an array of interesting and hilarious guests, we do a weekly dive into one-hit wonders like Eiffel 65's Blue, Krayshawn's Gucci Gucci, EMF's Unbelievable, Delamitri's Roll to Me, Los Del Rio's Macarena, Musical Youth's Pass the Dutchie, and even Patrick Swayze's She's Like the Wind. So are you subscribed to One Hit Thunder or what? As Desiree would say, you gotta be. And as K7 would encourage, you gotta come baby come and join in on the fun of the One Hit Thunder podcast. Come baby come, baby baby come, come.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is email your best song, via MP3 only, and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Shot Clock, a power pop punk trio from Richmond, Virginia, consisting of Pedro Ada on lead vocals and guitar, Ryan Smith on bass and vocals, and Sage Maxwell on the drums. Find them online at shotclockrichmond.com. Here's a snippet of their song, Can't Explain.
Every time I give it to you straight, I can't explain, there's something about the way you talk, something about the way you walk, drives me insane. Are you happy where things stand?
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
So Chris, I'm sure a lot of listeners will feel the same way I feel, but it was really cool to listen to, and for me, watch. I'm lucky I get to watch. But two pillars of the third wave of ska talk to each other. Less Than Jake and Real Big Fish together. I mean, that's just, doesn't get any better than that when it comes to the third wave, man. You guys are the third wave. I thought that was a really cool episode.
Yeah, it was awesome to catch up with old friends. The appreciation and love that we have for each other is just, you know, more so today than it ever was. And it's just because of time and the memories, you know, those memories we talk about on the show, just so many good memories with those guys. They were at the forefront of the third wave of ska. I think something today that kind of didn't surprise me, but just to hear Aaron say it, you know, there was just such a humility about him when he was talking about his lyrics and just saying, you know, like to me, they weren't meant to be goofy. You know, I'm a little bit goofy and a little bit wacky, but this is what we were living, what we were feeling. And I thought that was just a great, honest take.
Yeah. I mean, I experienced these lyrics. I experienced this music, you know, from a place of relating to it. And yeah, there was a fun aspect to it, but also I felt the heart in it. You know, this song's a more of a lighthearted song, but when you listen to that album, that Turn the Radio Off album, there's a lot of heart in those songs, you know, and maybe sometimes there's a little bit of a wacky presentation. It's more just in their live show and the fun of their live show. But yeah, it's not, I don't think it goes to cheesy. It could go to fun at some points, but I think that there's, yeah, heart is what I get from Real Big Fish songs. And I think, I don't want to name any specific bands, but I think there are bands that can take it to a point where it's like, oh, that's fluff, you mm-hmm. know? Yeah. And I don't feel that way about Real Big Fish whatsoever. You talked about how this is a well-crafted song. You compared it to Johnny Quest, Thanks for Sellouts, which I think is a great song too.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this think it's a great song as well. Both of the songs have stories to them, but this Real Big Fish Sellout, it's like pretty much like a complete story. You know, you get like We're thinking yes. about signing to the record label. We're signing to the record label. Here's what happens. And it feels like in the way that country music might tell a whole story, it feels like that with this song, you know?
It really does. That's a great observation. It's absolutely that type of track. And again, just to hear him, you know, talking about, you know, writing lyrics that were basically what he was living, and here it was. And what I was saying earlier about giving the comparison, it was just to our radio guy. I was thinking in my head, what's the more complete song? Not what the better song is, but I think this is a really complete song that they wrote at a very young age.
Yeah, it definitely is. And speaking of the young age, you've talked about it so many times on here. They're young songwriters at this time.
Yes.
And one of those things you do, and I'm not saying that you can't do this when you're a more seasoned songwriter, but you definitely do when you're young. When you're writing, you're thinking about what will the crowd do during this part of the song. You are thinking about that probably more than anything. The crowd's going to, you call it, Chris, guarantee you, you've done this. You call this part the bounce part.
Uh-huh.
You call this part the circle pit part. You call all these like punk rock world terminology, you call the parts that more than you call them the verse and the chorus, you know?
Yeah. Well, and you know, we used to be able to do that and go play songs live. They weren't going to wind up on the internet the very next day. So you had a little bit more play in that. You could go out and road test songs. And they knew this was a great song by the audience reaction before they ever stepped foot in the studio. You know, it at that point, to them, it was just another song amongst the bunch, but they knew that it at least worked in a live setting.
You can hear it in the album. You can hear that these have already been show tested because
yeah.
they work so well at the show. There's parts that are such sing-alongs, and I don't know, like, I'll give you a perfect example on this Real Big Fish album, the Snoop Doggy Dog song.
Yeah.
As just a song, you might be like, I don't know if that should make the album. I don't want to speak for them, but then you see you could see the audience response to a song like that and be like, oh, this is a great live song. Why wouldn't we include this on the album? I think that's really cool. I thought it was awesome how much Lockjaw was an influence. The Dancehall Crashers album Lockjaw, because I think that album is incredible. One of the best ska punk albums ever. And it's so funny that he told that story about how when he was writing the lead for this, he was basically playing a slightly different version of the Go lead, which is kind of like the Mark Hoppus story of him writing What's My Age Again. You know, he's trying to play the Green Day song. You know, it's kind of similar to that. It's like, I want to write something like this, you know, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, and you know, and we touched on Scott's harmonies, which, you know, another tip of the hat to the Dancehall Crashers. You know, Scott was doing these falsetto harmonies that at times it didn't even sound like a man doing it. It was like in a woman's register, and he did come up with some very odd, unique choices for harmonies that he got called out on, as he explained. You know, I thought that was yeah. interesting, but that's what set these guys apart. Unique, very unique harmony parts.
Yeah, I don't like following musical rules either. Some of them I don't know, and I'll get them pointed out to me by my like more music theory knowledgeable friends. Like, oh, why? No, change this.
Yeah.
Change it to this. I'm like, okay, I like it better the way I did it, not knowing why I did it, but I guess I'll do that. I don't really like following rules either, just in life. And I think it's so funny. I would have never in a million years picked out that the melody in this song was influenced by Morrissey. That is so funny. When he was singing it like that, I'm like, oh my God, that's so funny.
And when you listen to it, even the way that it's recorded and a little more peppy and upbeat, it's still, I said it to Aaron, it's kind of a morose, kind of a down melody line, you know, and you don't think of that for Sky. Everything's up and cheery, you know, but again, I think that goes back to the self-deprecating, not so serious part that he was trying to get across. And man, however it came together, this song and these lyrics resonated with a lot of people.
Dude, I'm one of those people who ska music not only meant back when this song came out, but still means so much to. I'm one of those people that he was talking about when he saw the documentary or whatever, like made him realize. And I'm really glad that Aaron ended this by saying that he heard the song on the radio in the past year and for the first time said to himself, this is a pretty good song.
Yeah.
Because I hate that it took him that long to think that, but I'm glad that he thinks that because he's right. It's an amazing song. It makes a lot of people feel good, and it is one of those songs on the Mount Rushmore of ska punk music.
Absolutely. I love a happy ending here on Krista Makes a Podcast. And not that kind of happy ending, but you know, a joyful ending. And,
A joyful ending.
If you enjoy hearing Chris and I talk as we do, you can get more of it at KristaMakes.com. That's episodes of our after party each week for the price of a cup of coffee or a nice little small cup of beer at your local watering hole. You can support the podcast that you know and love, KristaMakes.com, and give Chris a follow on Instagram at Chris Fafalius. He would love it. And give me one as well at Less Than Chris D. And I want to thank this week's guests, plural, Mr. Aaron Barrett and Scott Kloppenstein from The Real Big Fish. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, Chris Makes a Podcast producer Chris Fafalius here. You may have heard me talk about my band Punchline before. Maybe you already know us, or maybe you're hearing about us for the first time right now. It doesn't matter. No matter what your relationship with Punchline is, I will absolutely guarantee that you'll love our new podcast, A Band Called Punchline. Starting with our humble beginnings in a small town in southwestern Pennsylvania in 1997, we're telling the hilarious, strange, and hopefully inspiring story of the 25 plus years of our band in the most honest way possible, podcast style. A Band Called Punchline is an audio documentary available now wherever you get your pods. So subscribe and let me and my friends share a wild, entertaining, unique, and wonderful tale of music and perseverance unlike any other that's still being written today.
Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello out there.
Yes, hello out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!